I now will call the next case, our last case of the day. That case is number A24-609, State of Minnesota versus Robert James Cerny, Jr. I know both counsel are familiar with our procedures. So counsel for appellant, you may approach the lectern and begin whenever you're ready. Please identify yourself and your client.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jenna Yauch Erickson. I am Assistant State Public Defender, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Robert Cerny. Mr. Cerny has presented five issues for this court's consideration. I hope to have time this morning to discuss the first three, but I'd like to take them a bit out of order and start with issue two. Issue two pertains to the omission of the fighting words jury instruction. And I go there first because it is the most straightforward way for this court to resolve the case. The reason for that is because respondent has conceded error that is plain. That's clearly correct based on SLJ and Eile or Eile. So the question before this court is whether or not the omission of that jury instruction impacted Mr. Cerny's substantial rights, and it did. We know that for at least two reasons. First, because the prosecutor in closing argument isolated only three different behaviors that could constitute disorderly conduct, one of which was Mr. Cerny's words. The prosecutor repeatedly referred the jury to, quote, words and conduct. Second, because of the omission of the jury instruction, this jury had no idea that they couldn't rest their verdict on Mr. Cerny's words. They cannot because of the First Amendment, and because there is at least a reasonable likelihood that this jury based its verdict on protected speech, Mr. Cerny must receive a new trial.
Ms. Yauch Erickson, I have a question about the interplay between the first issue and the second issue. I mean, if we were to determine in resolving your first argument that there is sufficient evidence based on his conduct apart from his speech, which is one of the arguments that opposing counsel makes, does that change our analysis of your second argument?
No. The second argument, you have to ask different questions. So we know from lots of jurisprudence about how this court does a harm analysis, a prejudice analysis, that it's not solely based on the strength of the evidence. It's not a sufficiency analysis. Instead, you're asking how a particular trial error affected this jury and this verdict. So even if this court concludes that there was sufficient evidence of, for example, the volume, the manner of the speech to satisfy the disorderly conduct statute, nonetheless, it is still reasonably likely that the jury did something different, right? We weren't in the jury room. We're never going to know exactly what they based their jury on. And so the two issues ask different questions. Did this record give sufficient evidence for the jury to reach its verdict, even though we don't know what they did? Second issue is different. The question is, but is it possible? Is it reasonably likely that they rested their verdict on speech? It is.
Possible and likely, it seems, are two different things. So if we don't know what evidence the jury relied upon for its burglary verdict, doesn't that cut against you in a plain error analysis? Under the third requirement of plain error, isn't there, in a sense, a burden on the defendant to show that something, whether it's the likelihood? I think respondent's brief talks about, uses the term heavy burden, citing a Supreme Court case. So, if we don't know, can you get over that hump on the third requirement?
Certainly, Your Honor. We accept that burden. That burden is not a problem in this case. We never know in any case, except perhaps an exceptionally rare one, why a jury did what it did, ever. And still, this court will reverse and remand for new trials based on jury instruction errors. What's unique about this one and makes the prejudice analysis a little bit different than the omitted element cases that respondent relies on is here the instruction, it's addition versus subtraction. So when an element is omitted from a case, this court other courts essentially say, but we can look at the record, we can look at the arguments, and we can ask ourselves, but what would the jury have done if you gave them that extra element? That's addition. This is subtraction. The improperly excluded instruction here excised an entire category of conduct from the jury's consideration. So it's the inability to prove a negative. But the question for you is the standard substantial rights analysis. Is there a reasonable likelihood of significant effect on the verdict? There is, because it is reasonably likely that this jury, which the prosecutor, again, argued repeatedly that they could use his words, quoted his words, rested their verdict on those words. They had no idea they couldn't. Those words were just as likely to form the basis of their verdict as the other two types of conduct that the prosecutor used. And it's not, I don't suggest that this is math, but the question is reasonable likelihood. The prosecutor gave them three options, quoted the speech, and repeatedly told them you can rest your verdict on the words. All you have to do is believe that they did that. That's certainly reasonably likely.
Does it matter that, so, you know, often in First Amendment analyses, we're looking at the content of the speech, the meaning of the words, and so on. So in this case, I don't know, I mean, what he said, I think, arguably, it was not terribly significant, the words that he spoke. I mean, he said he expressed some reasons why he was angry and so on. But wasn't it really more about the, you know, the manner in which he spoke, the, you know, his loudness, his, first of all, being present when asked to leave, which is really not words at all. And the fact that he broke the window, which is, you know, disturbing, which is disorderly, and so on. I mean, weren't those really the primary features of the evidence against him for burglary rather than the words that he spoke?
No, in the sense that I don't think we can isolate one piece of the evidence as primary. That's not what the prosecutor did. And the prosecutor's argument is pretty good evidence of what the state thought was their primary argument. They didn't have one. They had three. And they were presented equally. In fact, if you then narrow the three that he told them down to the two he used over and over were words and conduct. He didn't just say conduct. He didn't say the conduct was worse. He didn't eliminate his argument about the language. He continually referred to both. So if we're talking still about the substantial rights analysis of the second issue, we don't have to eliminate all possibility that the jury made a proper finding. Instead, it's reasonable likelihood. And I would say that this jury, this Winona County jury, had a lot of reasons to find his words objectionable. The context simply makes his words more objectionable, that he was entering the private home of an ex-significant other, that he did so in a sort of rude manner. That all makes his speech worse, that he was swearing at her and using those words to her in particular, not to, say, a random member of the public or, for example, a police officer, as is often true in these First Amendment cases. That made his words worse. And I would sort of flip the supposition and say there's no way for us to know they didn't do that. It is reasonably likely that the jury did rest its verdict on the protected speech. For that reason, Mr. Cerny is entitled to a new trial on that count.
I'll just ask one more question on this issue, and that
yes.
Is there any case law in your mind, the case law that best illustrates this situation where, you know, we don't know what the jury relied upon, and so therefore, on a plain error, third prong, we find in favor of the defendant? I mean, either in the brief or in your head, do you have any cases that really illustrate that point?
So I think the closest, Your Honor, is Isle. And this is not discussed in my brief, so I can discuss it now, which is Isle or Ilee, I'm not sure how you say it, shows two things. One, that the respondents' set of factors that they take from the omitted element cases are not correct in this circumstance. So Isle is the closest analog, right? Isle is statute deemed unconstitutional because it targets protected speech. We narrowly construe the statute and we do a limiting instruction. All those things are the same, it's just a different statute. So Isle is basically the same legal issue as this, different statute. There, when they're reviewing the harmfulness, the prejudice of the omitted fighting words instruction, the only reason they don't reverse is because they were also charged, the defendant was also charged with disorderly conduct. So in that unique position of that case, they are definitively able to say what the jury did was proper, because essentially the other count duplicated the omitted element. So they know the jury found that element anyways. Or I shouldn't say found the element. I should say we know the jury must have rested its verdict on the category of speech. We know the jury didn't rest its verdict on fighting words because they got the fighting words instruction. They just got it on a different count. So the fact that that jury made the finding on a different count told the Isle court, we know that they didn't have an improper verdict. They definitively knew. Because you can't definitively know here, we don't have that sort of interplay, we don't have the finding in any of the other counts. We know that there's not a lot else to look at. It's whether there's a reasonable possibility that the jury did the wrong thing. And if you don't know they did the right thing, I would submit particularly on this record that reasonable possibility exists. I'd like also to turn to the third issue, which is the coercive jury instruction issue. The law is really simple. Don't coerce a verdict. There are two different categories of instructions that coerce a verdict. One, instructions that tell juries they have to reach a verdict, and instructions that tell the jury they cannot deadlock. This instruction did both. So what the court did was write on the jury's note, which is in the record as Court Exhibit G, and said, quote, you must continue to deliberate to reach a verdict. That instruction both tells the jury they have to reach a verdict and removes deadlock as an option. We know from the Kelly case, the instructions don't have to be coercive on their face. What you do is you look at what the jury would have reasonably understood about the message sent through those instructions. This jury had every reason to think they were required to reach a verdict. That's what they're told. Deliberate to reach a verdict. The closest case to this one is Olson. So in Olson, the court said, quote, you are to make a decision, end quote. That was found impermissible. You have to reach a decision. Here it's just you have to reach a verdict.
I have a question about Cox.
And, yes.
Cox was a case where the Supreme Court said this jury was not deadlocked, which made a difference there. And I think one possible way to read Cox is to say that all of this case law that you've referred to applies only for deadlocked juries, but if the jury's not deadlocked, those rules don't apply. Perhaps some other rules apply, but and so on. So, and I think this is respondent's argument. Do the prohibitions in Olson, Kelly, and otherwise, do they apply? Well, first of all, would you agree that this jury was not deadlocked under the Cox view of that? And secondly, if that's so, do the rules of Olson and Kelly, et cetera, do those rules apply?
Certainly, Your Honor. So I'll start with my interpretation of Cox. Cox does not set as a rule for all time in all cases that a question cannot mean deadlock. In Cox, the court was dealing with a question and said something like, I'm pretty sure they used the word note. We note that this jury wasn't deadlocked because they ask a question. And in the next breath, the court says, even if we do interpret this question as deadlock, here's the reason it wasn't reversible error. That's a classic dicta. It was not essential to the court's decision in that case, so Cox, therefore, doesn't create some sort of threshold issue where you can't ever get this law to apply unless you have magic words, an affirmative statement, we are deadlocked, period. But what's also helpful, if you look at Petrich and Olson, which are both cited in our briefing, those cases stand for the proposition that you cannot coerce a jury ever. It doesn't actually make a lot of sense to say there are times when a district court can coerce a jury, but there are times when it can't. So what Olson and Petrich say is it is most prejudicial, it is worst, it is the most bad when a jury expresses impasse. But the fact that it's most bad at one period in time suggests it's bad all the time. It's a degree question, a degree of prejudice question. And if you look at it, as sort of supporting evidence of that point. If you look at Jones and Kelly, they don't limit their holdings. When they're stating their holdings, they don't say, only when a jury is deadlocked, you can't do this. They just say, you can't do this. I would submit to this court, it would be error if a district court in its opening instructions, so before the presentation of evidence, told the jury, deadlock isn't allowed. That would be an erroneous instruction. It would just be a question of prejudice. And probably in a case where that's only stated to the jury in opening instructions, is perhaps cured later on, you would almost certainly find that not prejudicial. But Cox does not create a threshold question. And a lot of other case law suggests it is never permissible to coerce a verdict from a jury. It's simply that it is most prejudicial when that jury expresses a deadlock. I see my time has expired. Thank you for your time.
You will have an opportunity. Thank you, Ms. Yalk-Erickson. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for the state, you may approach. Please identify yourself and your clients, and then you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel. May it please the Court, Ed Stockmeyer. I'm an Assistant Attorney General appearing for Respondent to the State of Minnesota. The Court should reject appellant's sufficiency and jury instruction attacks on the burglary conviction, should reject appellant's jury deadlock claim, and should affirm the three sentences for the crimes against the officers closer to the arrest. I'll take the lead of Ms. Yalk-Erickson and just focus on the deadlock issue and the jury instruction omission. I'll start with the jury deadlock issue just because that's going to be freshest in my mind. What I didn't hear during appellant's argument is any emphasis on the plain error rule. This is an unobjected to issue, and so we're under plain error. And our basic proposition is that I think best case scenario for appellant is we have sort of two buckets of cases. Putting aside the Cox issue, we have two buckets of cases. And I think it is at least debatable about which bucket controls the facts of this case. And so if it's debatable about which bucket of cases controls, by definition, there's no plain error. That is the purpose of the second prong of the plain error rule. And so we think this court should resolve the deadlock issue by just looking to the standard of review.
Should we be concerned about the two issues in conjunction? We have no fighting words instruction, and then we have something that could be coercive. I mean, can we look at both of those things together and assessing whether there should be a reversal?
Your Honor, I guess it's the first time I'm thinking about it. Appellant didn't raise a cumulative error argument.
I know, and for all the times they do, I don't see it here.
So that would be my first answer. There's been no cumulative error argument raised. I think generally when there's no cumulative error argument raised, appellate courts don't tend to do that. On occasion, there are really severe prosecutorial misconduct cases where there's been sort of that examination of sort of the interplay between the errors, but there's just been no arguments about that in this case. So I would urge the court to look at them in isolation. But if moving for a moment to the omitted element issue, I think our arguments there are pretty strong on prejudice, and so I don't think there would be much cause to be concerned that there was some overlapping error here. In addition, there's nothing about these two errors that sort of, at least on their face, seem like they overlap in a way, naturally. So I don't know that there's a reason to be concerned there. Going back to the jury deadlock issue, I have a completely different reading of Cox than Ms. Yalk-Erickson does. And I'm just going to read to Your Honor sort of the money language from Cox that I'm referring to. So the court has that paragraph on pages 550 and 551 of the Cox decision where it lays out basically the argument we've made in this case. And then it concludes, thus, we conclude the court did not abuse its discretion in instructing the jury to continue deliberating because the jury was never deadlocked. And then it says, even if we were to conclude that the jury was deadlocked, we would still conclude that the district court's response wasn't an abuse of discretion. That's a classic holding and then alternate holding. So I think appellant is just reading the case backwards to say that the first part of the analysis is the dicta and the second part is the holding. Cox held that that where the jury was not deadlocked, there isn't an abuse of discretion.
So do you read the last sentence of the paragraph, do you read it to say that the previously identified cases do not apply because the jury was never deadlocked?
Yes, that's how I read it. And the important thing there is the court there isn't saying some sort of combination of, you know, the response here wasn't too erroneous or what we're not too concerned about it, plus they were never deadlocked. The court is only looking in this sentence about whether the jury expressed actual deadlock.
So if the Supreme Court meant that, why didn't it say that case law doesn't apply, rather than saying the district court did not abuse its discretion, which sounds like it's applying the case law, looking at the district court's actions in the context of the case law?
I guess, Your Honor, when I read that did not abuse its discretion, I sort of just read it, there was an error. In my mind, I've always had difficulty understanding the distinction between, you know, when we're talking about erroneous legal rulings, what is and isn't an abuse of discretion. I just think that what the Supreme Court is focused on here, this whole paragraph, is the jury didn't actually express it was deadlocked. But if I'm not convincing you about these arguments, about the plain error, or about the Cox, there's another issue to consider, and that is that we got a split verdict, or a divided verdict here. So the jury returned several guilty verdicts, and it returned several not guilty verdicts. And so we actually have no idea, looking at this record, which direction, assuming the jury was coerced, which direction the jury was coerced in. It very well may have been the case that when the jury submitted the note, they had hammered through all the guilty verdicts and they just had a couple holdouts who wanted to find the defendant guilty on the verdicts that ended up not being guilty, and that those jurors were coerced into returning not guilty verdicts. And because we're under plain error, an appellant has a burden to show error, has a burden to show it's plain error, has a burden to show substantial rights, if we don't know that the jury was necessarily coerced into returning guilty verdicts as opposed to not guilty verdicts, appellant still cannot carry his burden under the plain error rule.
What about Isle? I believe that your opposing counsel leaned on Isle for that point, right?
Or am I
mixing the issues?
I think you are mixing the issues.
I was about
to go right there, Your Honor,
or at least
to that issue.
I'll retract the question. Proceed as you wish.
Yeah, so I think what opposing counsel argued was that Isle stands for the proposition that the only way to find no prejudice or no effect on substantial rights for this issue is if the jury had a separate instruction on another charge that referenced fighting words. And Isle doesn't say anything to suggest that. I think that what's going on is the court found a ground for finding no prejudice in Isle, and that was sufficient. The court didn't need to look to any of the other usual factors because of that. So I think appellant's argument about Isle is a little bit maybe confusing or blurring the lines between sufficient and necessary conditions. I just read the case that because in that case, the jury did receive a fighting words instruction, we're just not going to be convinced it was prejudicial. In addition, I don't have the case with me. My recollection is that it was a mid-aughts decision. Since then, we've had some development of the law in jury omission cases. We have Watkins and the cases we've cited in our brief, which do tend to focus on three factors in particular. They focus on the strength of the evidence. They focus on whether the jury instructions otherwise encompass the omitted instruction, and they focus on whether the defense challenged the omitted element at trial. And if you look at the cases we cite, Peltier and Kelly, they really do suggest that you have really strong evidence of guilt and the defense is not actually challenging that fact, that you're not going to be able to the appellant is not going to be able to carry their burden on substantial rights. And so here, if you look, there was some, I don't dispute that the prosecutor absolutely referenced words and conduct a couple times throughout the argument. In fact, I think quoted some of Mr. Cerny's language. But if you also look at the defense's argument, what was the defense's argument on the burglary charge and the disorderly conduct as the predicate? All the defense argued was that this was a consensual entry into the home and that Mr. Cerny was under the impression that he was allowed to enter her home.
Let's look at the prosecutor's closing. So the prosecutor did say words and conduct multiple times. Could the jury have based their guilty verdict on the words?
It's possible, Your Honor. It's the appellant's burden to show.
So if it's possible, isn't that then, aren't we right into the heart of it's possible, it's reasonably likely that it affected the verdict?
Maybe I said possible too quickly. I guess what I would say is, if you look at the other factors, the overwhelming evidence that of his conduct that was disorderly, and you look at the defense's trial defense to the burglary charge, there's just no reasonable possibility that the absence of the fighting words instruction is the thing that caused the jury to return guilty.
But that's where it starts to blur the lines of issue one and issue two. So issue one, I agree with you. There's evidence in the record about conduct. And that gets to the sufficiency. Issue two, it's a different question where it's not just sufficient. Is there evidence of conduct? It's did the lack of the instruction affect the verdict? And if it's reasonably likely that words could have been part of their verdict, then that's affects the substantial rights.
I think the question is whether the absence of the fighting words instruction was reasonably likely to affect their verdict. And again, it's not just there was sufficient evidence of conduct that was disorderly. There was overwhelming evidence of conduct that was disorderly in this case. So just to go through Mr. Cerny's conduct, you have him shattering and crashing through the victim's bedroom window while she is asleep. They are no longer together. So they're no longer in a relationship. He is pacing angrily throughout the house. He's yelling, and there I'm referring to the volume of his voice as opposed to the things he was yelling about.
And again, I agree with you on there's a lot of conduct that the jury on which the jury could base its verdict. I'm struggling with the idea that the jury could have based its verdict on the words, and I don't know how to separate that out because unless all the words constituted fighting words, which I don't think they did here. But if they did all constitute fighting words, then it's like, all right, well, there's no problem here. But if there are words that did not constitute fighting words, and it was air that was plain to not give that instruction, then how do I know the jury didn't rely on the words when the closing for the prosecutor was words and conduct?
Right, and so maybe I'll come at it this way. In addition to the other factors and the fact that this was not at all part of the trial defense. I think the thing you're expressing is appellant has tried to say that this case is somehow unique for instructional omission cases, and I don't understand how that could be the case. So, for example, take an assault one charge where the state's burden is to prove great bodily harm, and great bodily harm has a particular instruction. And let's say the district court doesn't give the jury the particular instruction about what great bodily harm means. In that case, we don't know what the jury would have thought had they been given that instruction. We don't know. Maybe the jury thought that this was regular bodily harm. But the court still, the analysis is look to the strength of the evidence, look to whether the instructions otherwise encompass the issue, and look to the nature of the trial defense. And the court makes a call that does the omission of that instruction give us concern that this verdict would have been different had the instruction been given. And so there's nothing unique about the concerns you're expressing here. That's always the question in an omission case. But we look at these three factors. And in this case, where you have just this overwhelming disorderly conduct, particularly when you think about it in light of the Janicek case that I cited, where tipping over a garbage can is disorderly conduct, and then you think about what the trial defense was to the burglary, there was consent to enter the home.
But do we have to look at the trial defense? I mean, the prosecution strategy on which to convict was words and conduct. And so it's the guilty verdict and the strategy of the state that I think should be our focus, not necessarily what the defense was saying.
Well, I'm not aware of any case law that says that sort of like if the prosecutor's strategy somehow overlaps with the omission, that's sort of like the top factor, the most concerning factor. I don't disagree that that's something to take into consideration. It's these three big factors, but I also think it's a totality of relevant circumstances for a particular trial for substantial rights. But I'm just saying that where you have this much evidence and where you have this issue was not at all relevant to the trial defense, it's just not reasonably likely that the absence of this instruction is the thing that caused the jury to find the defendant guilty. In other words, that had the instruction been given, that the jury might not have found him guilty. They still would have found him guilty, in part because the defense is just saying, don't find him guilty of burglary because when he crashed through the window, that was actually a consensual entry into the home. That was their defense on this charge. It's not really a believable defense, and I don't think the jury would have bought it no matter how they were instructed. I think unless there are any further questions, I'm almost out of time, and I think I've said everything I want to say on those issues. So unless the court has any questions, I simply ask you to affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stockmeyer. Ms. Jarg-Erikson, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to say something relatively brief about the fighting words instruction and then turn again to the coercive jury instruction. I just heard a respondent focus on whether or not the jury, quote, still would have found him guilty. That is not the standard. It's not a sufficiency analysis, and this whole Big Bear and all of the cases that have been going on about how you do prejudice analysis say it's not just the strength of the evidence. It's not whether this jury still would have found him guilty. It's, but did they actually find him guilty based on his protected speech? That's what makes this different than omitted element cases. You can't just say, is the record such that the jury would have found that element proven? It's a different kind of omission. It's a different kind of omitted instruction that actually does make it unique. I can't think of another circumstance where a jury instruction says, you heard some evidence about X, but you can't use it as the basis for guilt, because it's different than Spriegel. It's different than relationship evidence. Saying that can't be the basis of your verdict because of the First Amendment. This is unique. And here it's a little bit different. It's addition versus subtraction. The question isn't, would they still have found him guilty? That's just the sufficiency. The question is, but did they? But did they rest their verdict? Is there a reasonable likelihood that they rested their verdict on his protected speech, which there is?
Ms. Before you move on, may we consider defendant's theory, strategy, and in light of the closing argument that defense counsel gave, which I think made no mention of the First Amendment, I mean, doesn't that diminish the strength of your argument?
No, Your Honor. I would say that might matter in omitted element cases. That's what the case law says. But again, here it makes a lot less sense. And perhaps if the district court hadn't plainly erred and omitted the instruction, that would have tipped off the public defender, hey, I should really argue that his words don't count and the jury can't use them. So one fuels the other. The omission of the element affects then what the closing argument is. So it all relates back to the district court's error and omission of the element. I would say, frankly, the defense closing argument just isn't particularly relevant to this issue. It's because we're not talking about strength of evidence or would the jury have found anyways. We're just saying, what did the jury find? In fact, perhaps because of the lack of argument, it makes it even more likely that this jury rested their verdict on speech because the defense counsel didn't tell them not to or that they couldn't. I don't think there's even any question that the coercive jury instruction is a plain error. The respondent is taking a very granular view of the law and essentially saying that because no judge has ever used this exact set of words in this exact order, it can't be plain error. That's not what the plain error test says. I think a really good metaphor is the way that the accomplish instructions have evolved over the past maybe 15 years. The first case, I think it was Milton, but I might be getting it wrong. The first time it came up, don't do hybrid instructions. Don't instruct on aiding and abetting this way. The first time they said not plain error. Wrong, not plain error. Every case since then, and I think there's been five or six Minnesota Supreme Court cases about how they keep district courts keep erring, making errors and giving accomplice instructions, don't any longer say this wasn't plain. They say, oh yeah, we've told you a million times not to do accomplice instructions this way. Please stop, prejudicial error. It doesn't fail to meet plain error simply because these same words haven't been used before. The law says don't coerce a jury. Here's the two kinds that coerce a jury. Here it's clearly coercive, so that meets the plain error test. I would submit, Your Honor, there's sort of an interesting question here about whether or not a district court can permissibly give a coercive jury instruction at any point. Because that's sort of what respondent is suggesting to you and what the respondent is asking you to hold, is that sometimes it's okay. That's not what Cox says. Cox didn't even really answer this question. They use it as some sort of threshold issue, but go on to rule on other grounds that it wasn't error for other reasons. Cox doesn't say you can sometimes coerce a jury. You can sometimes tell them they can't deadlock. You can sometimes tell them they have to reach a verdict. I don't think that would be good law. I don't think it's what the state of the law is in Minnesota. So I would ask respectfully if that's going to be part of this court's opinion that you publish it. That would be significant. It would be right or wrong. It would be a change in our law that would be important to have published for attorneys and judges to rely on and for the purposes of seeking any further review if we should choose to. It's almost like a preservation question, this issue of was the jury question enough? I would submit that it is. In Minnesota, we tend to be a little less direct than in other places. I think juries ask questions instead of make statements, but they don't say, what do we do if we're deadlocked when they're not deadlocked? It's not like asking, what do we do if a hurricane hits the courthouse? It's not entirely hypothetical. It's based in their reality.
On that point, I think Cox is clear that the what if question is hypothetical or it's future oriented, but it does not indicate a current deadlock.
Well, and perhaps I will have to raise that to a different court at a different time. I don't agree with that part of Cox. Nonetheless, it's I know my time has concluded, but on this point, Your Honor, respondent calls them alternative holdings. I would say anytime you have alternative holdings, one of them is dicta. I think that's in the definition of dicta. Saying we would do this, oh, we're not doing that, we're going to do this other thing, is the classic definition of dicta, which is what is going on in Cox.
But I think you're saying that the prior paragraph is dicta and the latter paragraph is the holding, and he's saying the opposite. Correct?
Well, I think logically the one that comes first can't be the holding. Why would the court continue to make analysis if they've already had a holding? I understand the idea of alternatives. I understand, but...
I would answer that question by saying that, you know, in the next paragraph, even if ... we would still conclude, which is, I think, the subjunctive voice, which is, you know, not the current situation, but some other situation.
Well, and
so it seems like that would be not the holding.
But. Yes, I think the even if is a good indicator that they don't find that dispositive in the case. It cannot be a holding if it is not dispositive of the case. Again, that goes back to sort of the Black's Letter Law definition of dicta.
Okay, you're saying even if diminishes the prior paragraph?
Yes, diminishes the idea that the threat, whether or not it's a jury question or a jury statement, is the holding of Cox. It's not, because they go on to say, that might be irrelevant. We don't know that we care. We're going to make this other holding. The holding is sort of the ultimate conclusion, the thing that courts tend to say last. I would ask this court to grant the relief requested in our briefing, unless this court has further questions.
It appears none.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Yauch-Erickson. Thank you to both attorneys for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days. And with that is our final case for the day, so we are adjourned.